Welcome back to Embrace the Grind. Before I hop into today's podcast, I want to let you know that Embrace the Grind is going to be going under construction. Possibly with a new name, I'm not quite sure yet, but the format of the show will be changing. A new year seems like the perfect time to reevaluate, and the fact is, the views on this channel have been down, and that's basically feedback for me. So I'm going to be implementing some changes to make the Embrace the Grind show more entertaining. But before I do that, one last episode in this long form interview format, I wanted to share the bulk of my interview with Nick Vertucci on his podcast, The Nick Vertucci Show. I wanted to share it over here on this channel. It was a chance for me to share some more intimate details of my poker story. More than my story, it was an opportunity for me to share some lessons that I learned along the way. For those of you that like this long form content, I recommend heading over to Nick Vertucci's channel and giving him a subscription. He's going to have you covered in that department, as he is going to be interviewing a lot of people, a lot of interesting people in and around poker. All right, let's hop into the interview. I'm going to give it all I got, all I got.
Mentioned to me in some of the notes you sent that you moved a lot growing up.
Yeah, definitely. My dad was in the army when I was young and started out in like Texas, moved to Germany on an army base, Colorado, Indiana, bounced around. My parents got divorced. And then at that point, living in trailers, never went to the same school for more than a year and a half.
Was that a negative?
No, I actually look at that as something that was a big positive in my life. I also look at it as something that helped me build an extremely close relationship with my brother, because we were bouncing all these different places so often that the one constant in my life
was him.
Was him.
So you go to a new place, he's who you knew.
Yeah, we were only 2 years apart too. Mm-hmm. So we were basically just automatically had a best friend wherever I went.
So it's a positive now, but when you were going through it, did it seem like a negative having to make those changes?
People always say that, but honestly, your perspective in the moment is just your perspective in the moment.
Okay.
You know, like I just was like, this is life.
I got it. That was the hand you were dealt.
Yeah. We move a lot. Like it's, cool.
No, why did you move a lot?
We financially struggled a lot. Okay. And so my mom was, she decided after my parents got divorced, my dad was working in a paint factory, that she wanted to go back to school. She had three kids. And going back to school meant that she didn't work. Mm. And, you know, my dad working in a paint factory wasn't, you know, he paid child support, obviously, but it wasn't a ton of money. And she made a lot of sacrifices, but she definitely felt like if she delayed gratification and went back to school, that she could eventually have a better life for us. And it ended up working out that way. You know, while we did struggle a lot and, you know, had the unfortunate circumstances when I was younger, I would say by the time I was in eighth grade, she finally graduated from college and she got a job as an engineer.
How old was she?
She had me when she was 19. So she got pregnant with me when she was 19. So definitely she started off, you know, down a tough path as it was.
Yeah.
But by the time I was in eighth grade, so what was this? I was like 14. So she was like 34 when she graduated from college.
Still very cool though. What a great story.
Yeah. So at that point, I remember she got her job, she was making like 50 grand a year or something.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, like 1994 or something. But it was like all the money in the world to us. And I remember she took us shopping for school clothes, because normally we would get like hand-me-downs, gifts, you know, Salvation Army, things like that. And she set us a budget, and it was like some absurd number. It was like $300 that we got to spend on clothes for the entire year, each three of us kids. Wow. And I remember going to like Macy's and just going nuts and just thinking it was like the coolest thing ever. But yeah, I look back on it now, and I don't think of it as like a struggle, because like I said, like it just was life. And you know, there was a couple moments here and there where it was apparent where I felt like an outsider. There was one time I remember very clearly in sixth grade, the entire team got basketball shoes. They were Nikes. They were like $90 or something. And my mom was like, we can't do that.
That ain't happening.
Like, you're not going to be able to get basketball shoes. And if you are getting basketball shoes, it's going to have to be $25 and it's going to have to be a Payless.
Yeah.
And so I went and I found like the shoes that closely matched the Nikes.
Yeah.
But I was the only one on the team that didn't have the shoes. So like little moments like that helped me realize that like there was a gap there. But overall, like, childhood was just childhood. And I look back at it finally, I feel like it made me the person that I was.
I was going to say, it probably built some real character for future.
Yeah, it helped me become the person that I am today, have the perspective that I have. So, yeah, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah, no, I understand. I get it. I won't get into it because it's not about me, but I have a little past like that growing up and come from the same kind of the same cut. And people had asked me, you know, and I'm just like, that was just my life.
Like, you know what's wild is I feel like it's seeped in, I feel like it's held me back in poker a lot, because growing up, like, the value of a dollar was very apparent. Wow. And for me to get to the point of my life where I am now, where I'm going into the Hustler and buying in for lots of money and losing big pots.
Yeah.
It was a huge learning curve. I'm 15 years deep into my poker career. So
yeah,
I just watched your Art Papazian podcast.
Right.
And
just
came
out today.
Which I really enjoyed. I didn't know a lot about art. I grew up in the Southern California ecosystem of poker, but I was more in San Diego. You guys had your LA thing. So I was kind of on the fringe of that. I would come up every once in a while and I would see art around. So it was cool to see his story, but he accelerated so quickly.
Yeah.
He was like 2015, you know.
Right time, right place, prodigy, studied hard.
Yeah, but that wasn't me, man. It was like a very slow grind to even get used to the dollar amounts that I needed to get used to.
Well, people often are curious, not all people, but especially people in my circle are often wondering why, like, I could be worth what I am and play like I do. And the truth of the matter is there's a lot of that inside of me. I'll just say it because it matters to the story, but, you know, same for me. I didn't grow up with money. I grew up, you know, my dad died when I was 10. I had like a key around my neck, you know, type thing to get into the house. And we didn't have a ton of dough. And then when I started my first business, you know, I lost everything and went broke into millions of dollars. And then lost another business later, didn't go quite as in debt, but it was pretty devastating. And so I learned over time that, like, nothing lasts forever. So I have this weird, I get trolled, like Ryan trolls me about it, but I have this weird inner thing where every dollar means something to me, not because money means anything to me, because people who know me know I'm very generous, but it means a lot to me because I understand the value of it, because it didn't come easy for me.
Yeah. And while that is good in some ways for poker, it helps you manage your bankroll, helps you take calculated risk, but it's going to hold you back from becoming elite. And all the elite players, you know, like Phil Ivey back in the day, you know, you guys talked a lot about Brian Kim, you talk about Garrett on art, even like they have this mindset around money. They're just chips at a poker table.
I get it.
And they're just betting units, and they can like separate and just play for massive amounts of money.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some crazy Brian Kim stories, by the way. He's actually one of my best friends in poker.
Is that right?
He's one of the reasons why I am the poker player that I'm today. He's the only roommate that I've ever had, other than my wife, obviously, and my brother. So yeah, we can definitely
save that because I'm going to get to that.
Yeah.
I actually, that's a very interesting topic for me, especially because it's him. But yeah, I've had this conversation with someone that's really good at poker that has said that's the one thing that could hold me back from being elite is that I'm just, that's the chip I don't have. Like the person that I'm referencing could sit at a table and just be like immune to the numbers, and they're not that they want to go broke because they don't, but they just have this different ability, and that is something you need to be elite, because if you have anything in there that has fear or the ability where you don't want to put yourself in that position, you are going to get outplayed.
Yeah,
right. Definitely. So it's a great point. Now you went to Purdue computer science. You told me you had a huge aptitude for like math, so you're kind of a geek.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
My mom is an engineer, obviously. It took her a while to get there, but she eventually got there. And I did have an aptitude for math, but I wasn't like the sharpest. Like I wasn't so quick about it. I was the kind of kid that would take a long time to turn in his test, but I would get a very high score after spending a lot of time
going
through.
You're very thorough, but not quick.
Yeah, definitely perfectionist by nature. But yeah, so I, and like no entrepreneurship in my family. You know, my dad worked in a paint factory. My mom went to college. She was like, you know, one of the first people to my dad's side and my mom's side to get a college degree, you know? So that was like what we were told was like, hey, if we're going to get out of this like lower level of income, the best way to do it is to go to college, use your math skills. Yeah. And I originally was going to go for engineering because that's what my mom did. And when I first got there, it was like the .com was like going crazy. And they were like, oh, we need software developers. We're paying them a lot out of college. And I didn't even need to get a four-year degree. I went to Purdue. It was like an associate's program. It was a two-year degree. It took me 4 years to get the two-year degree because I was working the whole time.
Sure.
Putting all the school on credit cards.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, I didn't have help from my parents from that, really. So, but yeah, once I got that degree, I remember my first offer out of college was from this Fortune 500 company in Indiana, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is near Purdue. They sent me an offer letter, and it was $52,000 was the bottom number. And I was like 22 at the time, and I was just blown away.
What's the bottom number mean? The bottom line number? I mean, that's what they
were. It was like the number that they advertised.
Oh, I see.
But really, like when I actually got my check, it was like maybe like 33,000 or something. Right. Because they're like counting how much it costs to put the lights on in the office.
Oh, so you got hit with health
insurance and, you know, like
they hit you with
your
401k
that automatically gets pulled out. So like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing that number and just being blown away and being like, okay, let me think about it. I'll call you back, and hanging up the phone and just crying.
Because it was so surreal that you could even
22 years
position.
Old, like yeah. $52,000.
That's cool.
And my mom was actually with me when I got the call, and we like cried together. And it was this really cool moment where I was like, wow, I'm actually going to be someone that could be on a path to make six figures in my life.
Wow. Isn't that something?
Yeah, like it was so cool.
Just what you saw then and what you know now, but it's all relative. And so you did that for 5 years where you wrote software code for a Fortune 500 company.
Yeah. And it was fun. I would say that, you know, I didn't really know any different. It was just a job where I got to use critical thinking and problem solving all the time. But I would say that I'm generally a naturally connected person to other people. Like I'm emotional. I like talking to people. Like at the poker table, I'm always talking to people.
Yeah.
Like I just like having fun. And when you're a software developer, there's not a lot of that. You're sitting in a cubicle, you're solving problems by yourself, and you're only communicating with the project manager.
Well, there's personality tests that show what people are good at, and some are very analytical. So it's very rare that someone could be analytical like that and have that social side. Usually those two don't go together. That's why you probably didn't find much of that with your peers.
Yeah, and no, definitely not. And also, I wasn't the best coder by any stretch of the imagination. Like I remember it would take me longer to do things. Longer to do my tests. Took me longer to write code. And when I did write the code, it was like three to four times as long as it needed to be. It got the job done,
got it.
But it wasn't the most efficient code. No. So yeah, I wouldn't say that it was like, I was just like killing it at that, but it was fun. And I was doing okay. But the only reason that I even was introduced to poker was because my little brother was living with me at the time. He was 2 years younger than me. So like I said, I got the job when I was 22.
Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah. And he didn't want to do the college route. He like tried it and like didn't enjoy it. And it was right when, you know, the moneymaker thing was going on, and he started getting involved in underground poker games and just staying out all night. I would wake up, I'd be putting on my tie in the morning.
God.
He'd be coming in and I'd be like, where have you been all night? He's like, been playing poker. How'd you do? I won $300. And I'm like,
wow,
that's insane. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and then there was another, but I still thought it was just gambling. You know,
like, yeah, you didn't see it as a career path or something. You just thought like, man, my brother's really, you probably thought he's probably messing up a little bit, right?
Struggling. Yeah. And like, I thought that, you know, I could just like show him the way by example, you know,
totally
going to school.
Yeah. You had it figured out because you were prepared to live your life coloring within the lines of what society tells you to do.
Of course. And it's just because that's what I knew.
Yeah. You know, that's what everyone tells you to do too, right? Especially if you do come from lower class income, that's what you're taught. That would be like a major goal, to get a degree and to get a job and to have $52,000 a year.
I made it.
You had made it.
Yeah. So like that was me making it. And my brother was not making it. You know, he was, while he was having fun and like playing poker and doing okay, like I didn't charge him. I think I maybe charged him like $100 a month for rent, you know?
And you said you lived there and he lived with him and Christy Arnett?
Christy ended up moving in with us.
Was that his girlfriend?
Yeah. He met her through underground poker. Like he actually met her at a restaurant. She heard him talking about poker.
Oh, wow.
She was super into poker. She was playing on like Paradise Poker or whatever. And
are they still together?
Married, yep.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they're still together. They've been together for 20 years or something.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
They've had their ups and downs, which is a topic for another
day. Who
doesn't?
Yeah.
But yeah, still together. I'm a proud new uncle now, Miles.
So they're looking good, though? They're going to make it?
Yeah. That's
awesome.
It's so great.
Well, didn't know that. That's really cool. But so living in that environment, you started to see the poker world from like maybe eventually a different lens. I mean, at what point you mentioned to me that you quit your job of 15 years?
I've quit my job of 5 years.
Of 5 years. Okay, I got that wrong. 5 years. And what was that? How did you make that decision? And how did you transition to go, okay, my brother doesn't have it wrong, whether he has it wrong or right, but now I think I want to color outside the line.
Yeah, there was a couple catalysts for that. One was just the longevity of my brother, like making it happen. Like over a year, he was still paying his bills. He had some money in his bank account. But one of the big catalysts, I remember he was playing on Party Poker and he won a tournament, like those step higher tournaments.
Yeah.
And he won a tournament for like $16,000.
Wow.
But it put him into a $16,000 buy-in sit and go. So now he's playing where all nine players are buying in for $16,000.
Oh, so you didn't get the money. You had to roll it into
a
single table?
You had to roll it into the next one. So he rolled it all the way to the highest one. He had like $500 in his bank account, but he has $16,000 ticket into this tournament.
Wow.
Kept trying to play it every month, They never were able to get this sit and go off the ground. So
Really?
So they finally just cashed him out and they said, here, take the money. Oh. He ended up taking that money, getting second place in a tournament in Fort Wayne for like another 8K or something. So now he has over $20,000 just saved, has it. And I'm here working for $52,000 a year. And I'm like, wow, maybe he is actually figuring something out that I don't know.
Yeah, you were struggling for air with that stupid tie you had to put on every day. Seriously.
Yeah. Wow. And yeah, it was pretty conservative. So yeah, the tie was a mandatory thing. So I started coming home and watching him. Another thing he did one time, I was giving him shit about like not, you know, working on his life or doing something.
Yeah.
He just started forwarding me the Poker Stars, congratulations, you have finished first place in a sit and go. And he forwarded me like 40 of them in one day.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, because they were like heads up sit and goes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how much money did you win today? He was like $450. And I'm just like, okay, maybe there's something that I need to look at here. So I started coming home from work, just sitting over his shoulder and just like, what are you doing here? And he was just employing a very simple strategy back then. It was just play in position, play aggressively.
Right.
And it was tournaments. It was singles and tournaments. So I was like, that seems pretty easy. I just deposited, you know, a small amount of money. And I started employing the exact same strategy, play tight, play in position, play aggressive. And back then, you could be break even just doing those things.
Right. It's a whole different poker world than it is today.
I mean, it's just nothing. God, I wish I was in Vegas again.
Seriously. I came in too late.
Yeah. So I was able to like break even from the very beginning.
Yeah. Rare. That's very rare.
Yeah. So that was like my training, him just kind of mentoring me along the way. But to get to the point where I actually considered leaving my job, it took a shakeup. Andrew actually moved to Vegas. And we had, like I said, we had been so close for so long that I missed him. He had only been gone a couple months. I was like, I'm coming to Vegas. Like, I'm going to figure out how to make writing software work in Vegas. Mm. So I came to Vegas with no intention to actually play poker for a living. But once you're in Vegas and you see the love that Andrew and Christy have for poker, how much they talk about
it. Was she grinding for a living too?
She was playing poker at that time too. She got a job for Card Player, doing interviews for Card Player.
Yeah.
But she was playing a lot of poker as well. And when you surround yourself with people that are so passionate about something, it just rubs off on you. And I started playing more. And eventually, I like to say that I quit, but my job was like, you're not cutting it. Like, something needs to happen here. And I was like, okay, we're just parting ways at this point. And I'm going to try to make it work here with poker. And I was playing like 1-2 and 1-3 at Planet Hollywood and the win at the time. And I was like, if I can just make what I make at my job right now, like it's a win, because it's the freedom. It's living in Vegas, being around my brother, picking my own hours, being able to go to the gym at midnight, like all these things, visiting my friends in Phoenix, 5-hour drive away, without having to like tell my boss that I need time off.
Yeah. You weren't in bondage to the grind of society.
And the first couple months like went well, where I made actually more than I did. And it's crazy, even though it wasn't like a linear path and I had ups and downs and, you know, lost all my money at times and had Andrew put me back in the game, ran it back up, spent too much money at the club, spent too much money traveling, spent too much money on girls, like all these things. I made a lot of mistakes. Once I got separated from that Fortune 500 life of writing code, 1 month, 2 months, 6 months, that window of me going back to that life.
Shutting.
It just started shutting to the point of where I was like, I can't do that anymore.
You can never do it.
No.
Yeah. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. Had some jobs, you know, in my teens, and at 22 started my own business. And, you know, I wrote in that book, one thing I wrote, you know, and even if you're grinding in poker or you're grinding in another business that's yours and not somebody else's, I wrote, you know, I'll work 80 hours a week, not to work 40. Mm-hmm. Just flat out. There's a whole difference of over, you know, working as much as you can. If you're doing it for yourself, you still have your freedom because it's your choice. You don't have to show up.
Definitely. Yeah. Working for other people is, I feel like there's a shelf life on your happiness and autonomy.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll be real clear for some of the people out there. Look, you know, if you're making a living and you're supporting a family and you're a blue collar worker or whatever it is, hey, look, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that I believe that there's more to life than that.
Well,
and that's
what
I believe.
Here's the thing is that if I would have never been introduced to poker and if I would have stayed in that life and, you know, built up my 401k, retired, I'd be in a great spot right now.
Yeah.
I'd have a happy life. Everything would be great. And so there's nothing taking away from that.
That's right.
It's just I've tasted both.
Yeah.
And personally, because I've been on this other side for so long now, I'm on this
can't.
Side now.
Oh, you can't. Yeah. You can't go back. That's if someone, if I had to do, I can't.
Yeah.
Literally can't. So I get it. And and that window, like you said, the longer you stay in the other side, it just shuts.
Yeah.
It's you're done. You got to keep figuring it out. So how long did it take you to work your way up the ranks? Tell me a little bit about that. You said you started playing 1-3 in Vegas. You did mention to me about building your bankroll up to six figures and losing it. Mm-hmm. Sounds like most poker players, you grinded your way, then you moved to San Diego, right? And started playing bigger. So
I was in Vegas for about 5 years doing the like 1-3-2-5 thing.
Mm-hmm. So you're making a living?
Yeah. I was, you know, making like $35,000 to $55,000 a year, which was like, you know, basically what I was making as a software developer, you know, and Vegas isn't overly expensive. I didn't have like all the typical Vegas vices with like drugs and that kind of thing. I did like to spend money at the club. But spending money at the club in 15 years ago was not like spending
when
money.
When you say a club, you mean a bar?
No, like excess nightclub, right?
Yeah, nightclub.
I would get like six of my guy friends together.
Table.
We would get a table.
Yeah.
It would cost us $200 a piece. Nobody knew where the DJ was. The DJ was in some back corner.
Yeah.
But that's all changed now. It's like now they have like headliners coming in. The DJ's in the main area. You're not getting a table and splitting it between six guys and spending $200
anymore. No, but you just, you know, and like you said, you probably had to grow out of that a little bit.
I grew out of it. You know, it was the first time in my life that I was actually single as well. So I was learning how to be single. I was learning how to be independent. I was learning how to make a living on my own. I was learning just so much about life, you know. But I did that for 5 years and I never really broke through any kind of ceiling. Like I never moved up to 5'10 in Vegas. I never really grew my bankroll in Vegas beyond like $30,000 to $40,000. And you need more than that if you're going to be playing 5-10 regularly.
Sure.
And I wasn't good enough to play 5-10 regularly. Not only was I like not great with my money at that point, I wasn't good enough to beat the 5-10 games in Vegas at that time. And one of my, by chance, I met a guy named Brian Kim, who was a kid in college back then playing in Vegas. And we just became like best buds, like right away.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I'm really close with Brian Kim, but I never knew that story.
And he said he was gonna move. He started going to Ocean's 11, and renting Airbnbs and playing at Ocean's 11. He's like, look, I think that you should come out here and like try it out here. Like I know you're kind of like stunted here in Vegas.
Yeah.
And I think that like this could help take you to the next level. Let's get a place together, like. He'll find a place for it. Like we found a place together. It was like right near the beach in Oceanside. And he got the master bedroom because he was making more money than me. And I got the downstairs bedroom and we just like moved in together and started grinding at Oceans like full time. Wow. And that was a major game changer for me.
How was that a game changer? What, I mean,
in so many ways.
Yeah. Tell me some of the ways, like, cause one of my questions here under Brian Kim's name, when you said it, I added it was, like, how did you study poker to get better? How do you study now? What does being in the lab look like to you? And how did Brian Kim make your trajectory faster or higher?
Yeah. So when I met Brian, I was playing like 2-5 in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And like I said, making like $35,000 to $55,000 a year.
Yeah.
And Brian was a 1-2 player. Was not
$1, $2?
Yeah. That's was so not winning money. He was like a college student. I remember distinctly one time I was at the Venetian and he came up to me and he's like, hey, can I borrow $200 to get in this 1-2 game?
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, I got you. So, but which I never did for anyone, but I felt like he was like a little brother to me. Mm-hmm. So I kind of felt like I was taking him under my wing. But then he had such a hunger for the game, mm-hmm. and he was younger and also didn't have that thing with money that I had. And he was able to like, he went all in with the study. Like he was all in on he networked with like other people that were like going all in on poker as well. And he just started ascending and he would talk to me about poker. Like we weren't overly like studious together. We were more just like buds. Like our conversations were a lot like, what do you think I should do about this girl that I have a crush on? And not as much like, what do you think I should do with ace king?
You know what I mean? Totally. I didn't know. So how did you study poker then and now? How what's your lab work like?
At that point, it was logging all of my hands in a database online on PokerStars. And back then it was all like, we could play on PokerStars. I was playing a lot on PokerStars as well and Full Tilt Poker. And looking through the database and saying, okay, I'm in the small blind with ace queen. How many times did I call? How many times did I three bet? What sizings did I use when I three bet? Oh, there's this other guy who I notice is crushing on Full Tilt. His name is Nicolak Poker. Shout out to John Kim, who's still playing poker today, I believe. What is he doing from the small blind? How often is he three betting? Oh, his frequency is this from the small blind. I'm not being as aggressive as I need to be from the small blind. So it was like a lot of self-study through like hold'em manager databases and modeling my game after who I thought were the best players online.
So smart, duplication.
Because we didn't have solvers. We didn't have card runners had just started, but there were no training sites like that. So, and I work best like just kind of diving into data. Like that's how I'm a data-driven guy. So yeah, my self-study was that. But it can only take you so far because I can see how much Nicolak Poker is three betting from the small blind. I can see how much I can see how often he's opening from under the gun, but I don't see the range of hands that he's doing it with.
That's right.
I mean, like ranges came later and, you know, I figured that stuff out later, but now I'm just trying to infer and I'm trying to make my stats match his through some like process of elimination and error. So
yeah, using what you can with the limited info you have.
Exactly.
Making the best of it.
And I was winning money online as well, but I had a decent rake back deal on Full Tilt. So when I would get tilted from playing live, I would go online. When I would get tilted from playing or bored from playing live online, I would go back to live. Oh, wow. So I had this balance of going back and forth. And then on Black Friday, when it shut down, it's like right when I was like, well, I'm not making as much as I need to make live poker. Brian's making good money in Oceanside. Let's go move in with Brian. Let's talk poker with Brian every day.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, see if we can like, if I can get better with like living by osmosis, by like living in the same house as him, talking poker with him.
Synergy, man.
Yeah. And just like, I feel like I was good for him in a lot of ways. You know, I was like, pick up your shit. Like, this is what you need to do to be an adult. Like, you know, and he was good for me in a lot of ways.
Did he ever give you any good pointers with the chicks?
So I had just settled down with a girl who I'm currently married now. We've been together for 12 years. So it's funny because my current wife, my girlfriend at the time, we moved in together with Brian.
Oh, okay.
I lived with Brian for 6 months in Oceanside and then she moved in. So she thinks of Brian as her little brother now.
Nice.
And we have this like cool family dynamic. We still like,
he's one of the nicest guys that I ever met in poker, even when he was a killer and I'm still a fish, but when I was a super fish, he was, and I know you're always nice to the fish, but he was legitimately like a cool guy and would a lot of times like give me pointers and say like, you know, whatever. And most pros don't do that. Right. So just a great guy. What do you do these days? Are, you know, I know you make a lot of content, with your vlog. It was very successful. Are you still in the lab? Do you still study? And if you do, what do you do now?
Yeah, there's definitely been an evolution. There was, like I said, that period of time where right after I went to Oceanside and started playing Ocean's 11 and started playing the 5-5 game, I started making six figures a year. And I was like, I'm just going to do this forever. Like if I can just make $110,000 a year playing 5-5, 5-10 at Palomar, I'm just not going to change anything.
Right.
Like this is the life. Like I work 25 hours. I work 25 hours a week, you know, like relatively low variance. I didn't even have to play very crazy back then. Like yeah. it was just like a relatively...
It was a different time.
So I didn't really study that hard, honestly.
Yeah.
It was just, I was coasting. And Brian was not coasting. He went from the 5-5 games where I was playing. He started driving up to LA and just disappearing for like 4 days at a time, coming home with like 60 grand more than he left with.
Yeah.
And then like he would be at Ocean's 11. And I had like a really good balance because I was building a new relationship with my wife. He would go and he would be like playing heads up for like hours upon hours. And he'd come home with every chip on the table, like 60 grand.
Yeah.
And like, so he ascended while I coasted.
Sure.
And so while we did talk poker and he would put me in some bigger games, sometimes take action from me. He was way more serious about it. And I didn't take poker serious until, because I was doing so well, until probably the pandemic. The pandemic is like when I was I probably need to do something right now. Otherwise, I'm going to get left behind. Like,
what? Why would the pandemic be the time for you to be left behind? Like, I don't track.
Well, because there was no more live games. And I was like, okay, so now I'm going to have to play online.
And it's harder.
And it's harder.
Yeah.
And like, I'm going to get exposed more. So now I need to study more. Mm. And
so it was a good thing of ultimately.
Ultimately, it helped me take... The other thing is the vlog helped me take things to the next level. Mm. Because I was like, now I'm accountable to more than just myself.
That's right.
And like now, and also getting married and feeling like, you know, also the game's going away. Game's dying. 5-10 game. Palomar got bulldozed. That place doesn't exist anymore. I used to go in there every morning, start the game at 10 o'clock. We'd play three-handed. And then the game, they would close at 2. It was a 5K buy-in. It was all recreational players. And it was just like my honey hole. That place
got raided, cherry patch.
Got raided by the FBI, got closed down, got bulldozed. So like these things happen and you're like, okay, now I got to go find somewhere else to play poker.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to move to LA because Olga didn't want to go to LA. So
what's her name?
Olga, my wife. Yeah. Olga, she didn't want to go to, she wanted to stay in San Diego. So we tried making it work in San Diego for a while. Did the vlog, started playing 5-5 again, which is pretty demoralizing when you're playing 10-20 and 5-10 and, you know, you're
making... It's hard to do that too and to stay disciplined when you go down.
You know, you're making... I was making like $150 to $170 an hour. And then now I have to play a game where I'm going to make $50 to $80 an hour.
Right.
And
so do you put in more hours? Do you accept
do I study more? Do I make more content? Do I like... I wasn't making any money off my content. So it was definitely a real crossroads. And I think that's one of the reasons why my vlog took off is because I was so open, honest, and vulnerable with the spots where we were at. Where I was like, hey, I don't have this game anymore. I'm going to make some videos. We're going to play 5-5. Like you guys are going to see how much someone who plays poker for a living can make playing 5-5. I did the series called Embrace the Grind where I played 30 days in a row, kind of just gave people an insight.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I'm jumping around a lot, but
no, it's okay. I think we're doing good. We're not jumping that much as you think.
But basically, once the pandemic happened, it was just another catalyst for me saying like, okay, I don't have my live games. I can't even play 5-5 anymore. Like now, all these games are going private. I don't have access to big games. What am I gonna do? Okay, people are hitting me up to play club poker online,
mm-hmm.
and so I talked to a guy who set up a club. He allowed me to play in his club. He allowed my brother to play in the club as well. And
it's on an app?
On an app, yeah. It was Poker Bros like back in the day.
Yeah.
And I studied and I also played. Like I would do meetup games where I would wake up and we would get together with guys at like noon. We play like 1-2. And then we would play for like 12 hours. After the meetup games for like that then, I would hop on and play 5-10, get my ass kicked. Figure it out, talk to Andrew, play 5-10 again, win a lot. And then I talked to the guy who ran the club. I'm like, he's like, hey, we're going to have to kick your brother out of the club. He's like winning too much money.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, who are the biggest winners in the club? And he's like, you and your brother. Like you and your brother, the only guys that are winning so much money. So I was like, okay, I am getting better. Like I felt like it was, once you're getting validated for actually doing well, it gives you even more energy to put effort and
that is true. I know that firsthand. Yeah.
And then, so then after the pandemic was over, still like big games were hard to come by. I'd done well online and, I actually done well with, Bored Ape. I bought a digital picture of a monkey for a low price and ended up selling it for a high price.
You're lucky you sold it.
Yeah. And then, you know, also the thing with online poker during the pandemic was like dealing a lot in Bitcoin and things like that.
Of course. Yeah.
That went up a lot.
It was going crazy. That and the apes and the frogs and all these pictures and the NFTs, they're like, going nuts.
Maybe I should buy some real estate.
How much did you make on an ape?
With all like when it was all said and done, over 300,000.
What the hell?
Yeah.
Who the hell pays that much for a picture of an ape?
Yeah, it was crazy.
I never got it.
I got so lucky. Like I don't pretend to be
no,
like,
I get
some
it.
Genius.
It was timing.
It was timing. It was like timing with the pandemic and actually getting a hold of some cryptocurrency at that time when it was like $3,000 a coin.
Timing.
Went up to $60,000 a coin.
Boom.
Decided, hey, this is kind of a risky investment. Maybe I should buy a property. Bought a property in Cabo.
So smart.
Now we're Airbnb-ing that. That's making us, you know, $5,000, $4,000 a month
Very
or whatever.
Smart.
So like I've finally started making some decent decisions in my life.
That's good.
And, you know, things have obviously gone well for me.
You got to take care of Olga.
Got to take care of Olga. Mm-hmm. The pressure of my brother just crushing it, like...
A little bit of a competitive nature to catch up.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the reasons why I started switching to tournaments is because the big games, like you and Art talked about in a previous episode, you can't just walk into a casino and play a 10-20 game even anymore. Like, how crazy is that? 10-20.
Yeah.
Commerce would have like 12 10-20 games back in the day.
I've said that a million times. I don't understand it. Like,
do they even get a 10-20 anymore?
Well, I played in one. What's today's date? December what?
The 26th.
26th. Yeah. Maybe 3-4 weeks ago, I went in there screwing around and there was one table.
Okay.
Doesn't happen very often. And it had about 4 players in there that were, including me, that were not great for the game.
Yeah.
And all the local guys I recognized from, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And, but no. And I was going to ask you, why do you think back in the day, I asked Art this and I don't think we really had an answer. I guess maybe people going broke or the game's changing and it's not as easy. I don't know what it is. But like you said, 10, 15 years ago, you can walk into the Commerce Club and there was like 8, 9, 10 tables deep and it was must moves and the action was sick and it would go for days. And it's like now you go in there and it ain't happening nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Well, in my personal opinion, there's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is the privatization of games. There's definitely been
But there's not a lot. Like, for that many games, like, you have private games, but they're not, they don't compete with the abundance that there was.
The other thing that I think is happening is a lot of the guys are moving to tournaments.
Mm.
And another thing that I think is happening is that the recreational players, there's two different classes of recreational players that were really feeding the ecosystem back in the day. There were the recreational players that always lost and always played passively and always called it off. And those were the ones that you just loved.
Right.
And they were the ones that got eaten up.
Right.
That like disappeared quickly.
Yeah.
The other recreational players that were aggressive, that actually won sometimes, would walk out of the casino like $15,000 richer sometimes, usually $15,000 poor, but sometimes they'd actually win.
Sure.
They're the ones that actually got moved into private games. They're the ones that actually still survive to this day. Aren't quite as like, you know, you don't really love playing with them, but like you're like, okay, this is still.
They're
like,
not total fish.
Yeah, they're not total fish.
Like, yeah, there are a lot of recreational players that can hold their own.
They're going to crush you sometimes.
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. You know, I found something interesting. It goes back to what we were talking about studying back in the day, what players didn't have and what they have today and all the different mathematics and the solvers and the charts. I did a 2-hour interview with Daniel Negreanu a week or two ago, I think
it
was.
Here.
I Zoomed him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's too big time to
come. Yeah, I was
going to
say, that's pretty big.
Yeah, it would have been
got
cool.
Got him into the end.
No, I got him onto the Zoom, but it was a great, it's going to come out probably after the first year. It was a great interview in so many respects. It was one of my favorites. But regardless, the point is, we were talking about like back in the day, the legends, and some of them, you know, poker just passed them by. And then some like Daniel and some, you know, were able to stay relevant and study and catch up and, you know, bring their game to what it is. And he was telling me, which I just thought was so interesting, but really, if you think about it, it had to be done this way. He was saying like, you know, a guy like Doyle, you know, there was no solvers, there was no charts. What he would do is he would take ace king and put it up against whatever hands, and he would run out of board 300 times to see what
that's
the fucking wild. Stats were.
Right? Yeah,
that's wild, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's wild,
yeah.
You know? And
that's true dedication to the game.
Yeah, that's like, but I never thought about it like that. And when he told me that, I thought it was one of the, and there's his book, by the way, The Super System. That's okay. The old OG one there.
Yeah.
But it's so different how it was back in the day. And then even it evolves to the moneymaker time and where the boom happened. And even for a guy like me that could semi walk out of the casino with a win here and there, right? Like yeah. I'm that guy back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, it was so juicy. And it just like what I know about poker now, if I could just be in that time, like it's yeah. so, my God, for the crushers were just probably, I can't imagine how much they miss it.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of respect for people that have made poker as their primary source of income or a large portion of their income or.
And made it.
And done it for a long period of time.
Yeah.
You know, 15 plus years.
Not easy, bro.
And here's the thing about myself is like, I would never have been able to do this if it wasn't for the support system around me. If it wasn't for the supportive wife who always was encouraging me when, you know, when you're at the casino and you're down thousands
of dollars. You hit some low points, yeah.
And you message your wife and you tell her that. I had the kind of wife, it took a while through like, you know, her learning how things worked. I had the kind of wife that was like, how you feeling? Feeling good? Give me a pep talk. You got this.
Good for
you.
Let's
break the game. Let's
good for her.
Let's wait till it's heads up. You're eventually going to be heads up with a guy that doesn't know what he's doing and break the game tonight. We'll see what happens. I'd come home and like half the time I would, you know, make back a ton of money. Other times I wouldn't. She'd be supportive. She'd be like,
there's real power behind having someone like that in your life.
And then my brother, you know, like I coasted for so long and my brother was like, hey, I'm not coasting.
Get your shit together.
Like we're going to like, if you want to like, study with me, if you want to like be in the same like poker conversations with me, you're gonna have to study. So he pulled me up. Like I went broke a couple times and he gave me money. And honestly, like he went broke a couple times and I gave him money. So
yeah,
just having this support system,
mm-hmm.
there's no possible way that I would have made it 15 years with poker being my primary source of income if I didn't have like a very strong, robust support system.
Yeah, I think I played with him once or twice. He played on the stream once or twice. And what a nice guy.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah, he's like my guru.
He's such a pure, nice guy. Like there's no phoniness to that.
Well, he's deep. He like thinks about the world in a very deep way.
Yeah.
And he doesn't talk a lot, but when he does talk, it lands.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very nice guy. And I've gotten to know you just a bit, not a lot. And I feel the same way. Like, regardless if you guys didn't have two nickels rubbed together, you're raised right. Somehow something happened good in there because you guys are both like good people. You don't fit in to a lot. We'll get to this. You don't fit into a lot of the poker community because you're so nice. Like you're not supposed to be nice in the poker community. Yeah, I don't think that's what I'm learning.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I mean, we can go down the content route now. I mean,
yeah.
The thing about content when I first started creating it is that it was poker players who were just looking for creative outlets to express how things were going in poker. Like it was a cathartic experience for me. I would actually post videos more often of me losing because it was like a way for me to like vent.
Sure.
And, you know, get away from the poker.
And people love that. They love self-deprecation. They love you to expose yourself that you're not just trying to be like the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
You
know? And like, I didn't, there was no beefs. Like I didn't have to like talk mess about Andrew Nimi, who was like a friend of mine, you know, like I didn't have to be like, oh, his vlog sucks or whatever.
Right.
But now it's evolved to the point of where you don't even have to be a poker player to start becoming popular as a poker video maker.
Yeah.
You can just come into it and say, I'm going to go all in on videos. This is kind of what Rampage did. But what I give Rampage a lot of credit for is he actually became a good player. You know, mm-hmm. he yes. attacked it from the I'm going to create content first route, and he followed it up with like study and results. And he's got rings, he's got bracelets, he's got high roller wins. Like,
yeah.
I give that guy so much credit.
Totally.
But
the evolution of him so fast is crazy.
Yeah. But what's happening nowadays is people are coming into creating videos for clout, for an opportunity to make money, for the wrong reasons, in my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And
people can feel it.
One of the ways that you get attention is by controversy or drama or talking shit.
Jesus.
Or, you know, throwing other people under the bus. Mm. And it's obviously never something that I've done. And I don't like it because regardless of how you try to separate your online persona from your real life persona, it's pretty much impossible.
Yeah.
If you are doing something online, like calling someone out or having a beef with someone, it's going to affect you in your real life. Like, even if you try to separate it, there's going to be something there that you take home with your wife, and maybe it comes up in an argument, or like, fuck, now you're irritable, or like,
sure,
now you're not being the like best version of yourself because you have this energy out here. So it's kind of unfortunate, because I actually find myself falling into this trap too. Like, if I see something that is drama or clickbaity, I click on it.
Yeah.
I watch it.
Yeah.
Like the whole Jack Four thing. Like, I was like watching Joey's live streams. I was watching, you know, video replays of everything.
Yeah. It's like when we drive, that's why there's traffic when there's an accident. Everyone's going to slow down and take their look, man.
Yeah. So as much as I say, like, I don't want to be a part of it.
You understand it.
I understand why it is. And like,
yeah. How do you feel about it though, ultimately, even though you'll stop by and take a good look at the crash, how do you ultimately feel about that? Do you think there's a place for it? Do you think it's fine? Do you think it's reckless? I mean, whatever.
Yeah. I think that it's bringing more eyeballs to the game of poker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an industry that has struggled to grow.
Yeah.
So I think that in a holistic look at it, I think it's good. Like, having mm-hmm. drama, having discourse, having back and forth. The problem is that if I'm involved in it, it's actually like bad for my life. Bad for my well-being.
You fell prey, you mentioned to me, because we talked. By the way, you were one of the – I have a lot of people that support me off the field. But you, during this Jack Four thing and some of the targeting that was coming my way, you were one of the only people that stuck up for me online. I don't know if you know that. There's a couple people that did, but – well, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say the only people. There's a handful of people did, some vigorously for me, close friends of mine. But we weren't close friends, and you got in there and were like, this is retarded. This is ridiculous. Like, this mm-hmm. is no way this happened. And like, stop yeah. that, you know. And I want to thank you for that, because not a lot of people did that, you know. Yeah. And but you have said you've fallen prey to getting attacked and then fighting back and having it be completely negative EV for you to have done that.
For sure. Because
that's what happened.
It goes back to the energy thing that I was talking about.
Yeah, the energy.
But honestly, like, you and I didn't grow up in social media.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not even that much older than me. I'm already in my 40s, so.
I'm older. But go. I get what you mean.
So I didn't even create my first YouTube video until I was 36.
Mm.
So I had no social media profiles. Like, I was like not mm-hmm. popular on social media. I was a guy that played poker and stayed under the radar and like
sure. didn't
travel the tournament circuit. Nobody knew me. Unless you lived in LA or San Diego or Vegas, you probably didn't.
But play starting these vlogs and becoming more known in the poker community, you took a few shells.
I was learning on the job.
Right.
You know, so.
You took heat for markup in a WSOP from a couple people. I think it was Sean Deeb and Doug Polk. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like I said, the first probably 2 years of me creating videos on YouTube, it was so much praise. It was like, thank you for showing us the real side of poker. Thank you for making videos. Oh my gosh, your videos are so great, high quality. And that kind of got to my head a little bit. I was like, wow, people really love me.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it feels like, good when someone affirms you, right?
For sure. And especially when you're not used to it and you've never really like created like content like that or never didn't have no experience with this kind of thing. It almost feels like a drug, you know?
Totally.
And then when you have someone who, and I'm like, these people see me. These people, like, I'm like letting them in. I'm being vulnerable with
right.
them. And then when you have someone who starts to attack you, who has a voice, who has a platform, Sean Deeb had a platform. He had tens of thousands of followers on Twitter. Doug Polk had a platform. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on YouTube. And I'm like, these people have never watched one of my videos. They've never played poker with me. They don't play cash games in Southern California.
They don't even know you.
They don't know me.
Yeah, your character.
And they're calling me a scammer. And I'm like, this is just outrageous. Like,
How bad did that hurt? Be honest.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Because when someone who I kind of respected them in a lot of ways. Like, I respected what Doug Polk had built in his business.
He's very good at what he does.
I respected him as a poker player. I respected Sean Deeb as a poker player. I didn't know them otherwise.
Sean Deeb's one of the top poker players out there.
For sure.
He's very good.
Yeah. So I had, when I had those things coming at me, first of all, I wanted to defend myself because like, I'm like, inaction is almost like affirming.
I know.
You know,
it's a real head fuck because if you lean heavy into it to defend yourself, you just get slaughtered because you can't beat it. And then if you lay back, like you said, then you're just like, oh, it must be true because he won't say anything.
Yeah. So I started with the comebacks, and some of my comebacks were like hurtful, you know, like I mm-hmm. said mean things to them, which actually made me feel worse. Like I say damn, bad dude. Shit and now all of a sudden I'm feeling worse. So it's like, it wasn't even working. Like, oh, I got them. No, I didn't get them. Like, I got myself, really.
This conversation wasn't planned. I say this every time when I'm talking to someone because they think it is, but you just outlined exactly how I felt when, I'll just say the name. I usually avoid it, but like Matt Berkey was attacking our show. Not, he attacks me now personally, but only because we went to like war and I did what you did. I leaned too far in. But I will tell you that the same thing for me, it just was not a positive for me. Like I'm not, and I'll, maybe he is. I think he's something. I'm not a narcissist, right? Like I don't have the ability to not give a shit mm-hmm. totally. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I think he does. Okay. So you can't win a war against somebody that just is always thinks they're completely right. And so for me, when I said things and I outed him on something and did some things, it really made me feel worse. Not feel worse because I got any negative feedback from it. Immediately I did, when I put up a post, I immediately felt worse about mm-hmm. myself and I took it down prior to anything being said or done, but it was already up there and the damage was done. So I have fallen prey to this exact thing. Well, I'll just say it too, like just because people like hearing about this shit. There's two posters over there,
yeah,
okay, that are not up on my wall. I've had them for a while now, okay? They are of Matt Berkey. I'm not going to say what they are, but they are in reference to the thing he has right next to him. So mm-hmm. now you guys could go give him some clicks. Yeah. Right next to him where I had my social media team who put up 7 years ago a mm-hmm. meme that said something about successful people break the rules. Mm-hmm. Well, he turned that into me like, oh, well, if he break the rules in anything, how, first of all, he didn't even know what the fuck he was talking about because it was 7 years ago and he thought I had just put it up because someone else put it up and he leaned into it. He never does his research. He's like only lies. Okay. I don't care. So now I'm dead. He's going to go do his thing.
And at this point, you might as well just put the posters up because you're going so far down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. So whatever. So I could always edit it, but I'm not going to. But, and so point is like, I made something up that I was going to put up to just kind of have fun with. And then like when you came in and you saw it, you're like, oh, holy shit. And then I said, yeah, I just have been reluctant because like you said, as soon as I do it, as soon as I say this and the pod's out, it's like now I'm opening that same negative energy up to me. And I'm only talking about because this happened, it's true, and we're on the subject. But it's, yeah, it's a real shame because you can't win.
No.
Yeah.
Especially with, you know, I would classify Sean Deeb as someone who doesn't think that he's ever wrong. And also,
I see that.
And also, Doug Polk doesn't think that he's ever wrong. He's like very, they're both very opinionated on what they believe. And
same with Matt.
Yeah. So when I tried to fight back, it didn't work, obviously. Like they're like,
oh, they don't care.
Yeah. And they don't care. Yeah.
And they, and like Doug has, and I know you mentioned this, you're good with Doug. I'm good with Doug too. I consider him good now. We're friends. But you know, these guys that have hundreds of thousands of people, they're like little armies mm-hmm. and they live for this shit. They love when that kind of stuff happens because people feed off it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so like, I obviously made a lot of mistakes with that. And,
but what do you do now if it happens? You just stay quiet?
It's hard to say, man.
Because recently I've seen you go back and forth with Sean. Didn't you?
Nah.
No? Was that an old thing?
I don't.
Maybe not.
Nothing too big, serious.
Bad, yeah.
Yeah, if I'm back and forth with Sean, like it's just it's an accomplishment that we're both not blocked now, you know.
Right, from each other?
Yeah. Right. So that says a lot.
But why do you, okay, how about this? Because I'm good with Sean too, I hope. I don't know how he feels about me, but I have no beef with him. He's cool to me. If he does stuff that says stuff, then I don't hear it. I don't know. But why? Why would your percentage markup matter to somebody? Why would that happen? And the reason I keep asking this to guests that bring it up themselves is mm-hmm. because I'm perplexed by someone who wants to go after someone for that. Like, why? Yeah. Like, well, I don't give a shit what you do when you mark up. If someone wants to pay it, who cares?
Yeah. I will say that he didn't just do this with me. Like, he's done this with a lot of people.
I know that.
So I know that that's not special. Constant.
No, it's not just you. It's everybody. But why is my question? What is the reason?
I don't really want to dig into that. But what I will say is that when I did those things and I realized that I wasn't accomplishing what I wanted to accomplish, I ended up just betting Sean. I was like, I'll just bet you that my World Series of Poker results will be better than your World Series of Poker results.
But what did that have to do with what you charged?
In these tournaments that we're mutually playing together, in the package that I'm selling, because okay. I feel like I'm winning in this package.
Right.
And all that really, in my mind, if I make this bet, then he can't talk to me anymore. Because like I'm putting my money where my
mouth
is.
Got it. You're not trying to hustle someone. You're saying I'm worth this price.
Yes.
And I'm willing to bet you that I am.
I'm willing to bet you that I'm going to do better than you in these tournaments. And I won.
Did you guys bet?
We did bet.
Oh.
And I won the bet.
How much?
It was for $5,000.
Cool.
1-1.
It was more at the principal.
Yeah. So I actually got to collect $10,000 though. That's the part because we had to escrow. So it feels better.
Yeah. You guys didn't trust each other, huh?
Yeah. Well, he said that he wouldn't bet with me unless I escrowed.
Okay.
This is another piece of the story, but I escrowed with Joey Ingram that day that he said that. I was like, okay, I'll escrow with Joey.
Oh.
Is Joey fine with you?
Very interesting.
And he's like, Joey's fine with me, somebody that we both trust. So I immediately sent Joey $5,000. When it was time to collect the $10,000, I was so excited to go to Joey and collect that $10,000. Joey was like, Sean never sent me any money. And I was like, oh, so I have to escrow.
Wow.
But you don't have to escrow. And then he's like, oh, come on, I'm good for it. And I'm like, in my mind, like, I'm way more good for it than you are.
You know,
but in his mind, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So I was just like, no, like, I don't actually want to see you. I don't want to be in your presence. So I just want you to honor the agreement that we had.
Send it to him.
Send it to Joey. I'll get it from Joey. And he's like, what, are you scared to talk to me? And I'm just like, no, I just don't want to be around you. Like, it's not part of our bet. So he ended up giving it to Joey, I believe. I didn't have to see him regardless. So.
Right. Have you seen him since?
Yeah, we actually.
You good?
We got in a huge argument at the WSOP one time in the hallway.
After this.
Oh my God. I was drinking, you know.
Right.
And I it was the first time I'd seen him since that point. And I saw him in the hallway and I said, hey, tough guy, you want to talk right now?
Wow.
And I got in his face and I was like, what do you have to say about anything that's happened? Like, you have a big mouth online, you want to have a big mouth right now?
Wow.
You know, because
what's up, Antonio?
I hate bullies, you know.
No,
and
I do too.
And I felt
like
I felt like it was my chance in real life to stand up to an
what happened
bully. Nothing. He backed down and he was just like, you know,
no, we're cool.
No, he was talking shit.
Oh, okay.
But he was like, it was just not a productive
too many cameras too, you really can't go.
It was not a productive conversation.
Yeah, it's dumb.
Since then, I believe I've sent him messages saying like, no hard feelings, I've unblocked you. No.
Did he reciprocate that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But we're fine.
Like, okay, good.
We're not going to be friends, but we're not going to be enemies.
Yeah. And I want to be clear. I have no beef with Sean. I'm not, this is just your story. So you're telling it. Same with Doug, nothing.
But with Doug, it's completely different. Like Doug did call me a scammer. And I did like exceed my markup. My markup was, which was not even very high, honestly. It was for Main Event, Colossus, Millionaire Maker.
Mm-hmm.
Monster Stack, those tournaments.
What was the markup?
1.38. It was 38% markup, which arguably should be higher because it includes the main event and everybody sells for absurd amounts for the main event.
Got it.
But, and it's those weekend tournaments, which is all like massive fields, huge payoffs. So
yes, yes.
I think it was probably a little bit low, but because I didn't have a tournament track record, in their mind, I was scamming. Anyways.
Oh, I see.
I made close.
You didn't have the ability to charge that because you weren't proven.
Yes.
Okay, got it. I never knew anything about it. Okay.
But I ended up cashing like all the tournaments and having like a 60% markup or 60% ROI, something like that.
Yeah.
Doug never apologized, which I didn't expect him to apologize, but I've moved past that. And good. Now like Doug and I have like normal discourse on Twitter.
That's great.
There's no point in holding grudges. Be. Like,
glad.
I'm not the type of person that wants to have this kind of energy in my life, which is why like I'm fine with Sean now, fine with Doug. If I saw Doug in person, it'd be like, hey, what's up? Hi, my name's Johnny. You know, I've had discourse with Phil Hellmuth as well. You know, like I don't know how. I think this is it. As an older brother, I have a real issue with bullies. So if I see someone who I think is a bully, Sean D, Doug Polk, Phil Hellmuth, I just don't like that personality. I don't like that energy. I stand up to bullies. You know, I remember my brother was getting bullied one time in like seventh grade. I stepped in and handled it. Like, this is just who I am as an older brother.
Yeah, know? We're a lot alike that way too. I feel the same way. I've always been for the underdog. But here's the thing. It's the online stuff you can't win. So the only way to stand up to a bully is in person. Mm-hmm. Because online, you're just drawn dead. Yeah. Especially if you care. Yeah.
I've learned a lot. And when you say, like, how would I handle it nowadays? Like, I would do my best to take the high road.
Yeah.
However that looks. I don't know how that looks.
I'm trying to do that in every case. Like, I'm really trying to do that. It's the only way you can survive and keep your, like you said, because if not, that negative energy, that toxic shit rolls into your relationships. It rolls into your kind of your attitude. For me, it ran into my poker game.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't have much poker game, but whatever I do have, it affected it right after the Jack Four, and I couldn't win.
It's going to be interesting now because I more or less switched to tournaments recently. Yeah. So I'm not going to be traveling to like Borgata. Like I'm not that much of a tournament player.
No, I get what you mean.
But like in Vegas, in Southern California, some of these big events, like I'll be playing. So I'll probably run into Shandeep. I'll probably end up at his table sometime.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you guys can split a burger or something.
It'll be fine.
All right.
It'll be fine.
Good. I'm glad. What's your vlog? How many followers do you have on your vlog on YouTube?
A little north of 50,000.
That's cool. Yeah. And do you generate some revenue from that?
Yeah.
Do you okay?
It's interesting. I said a long time ago, like when I first started out, I was very like anti ads on my channel. I was anti selling out is what I thought it was.
To take advertisements?
Yeah. Because I was like, I'm a poker player. Like I'm just doing this, my creative outlet. Yeah. Like I don't need to sell out. Like I make money playing poker. But then like, once I got over that and was like, oh, I need to make a living.
It's a business, bro.
Like, this is a business.
Yeah.
And I need to take care of my wife. Like, what if we have kids? Like, I need, you know, like all these things. Yeah. Like, I got over that.
You don't need
to
be a purist when it comes to that.
So my new rule was I won't advertise anything on my channel unless I personally use that product or believe in it. So one of the things that I advertise pretty heavily was range converter, because it's like the primary way.
What's
that
it called?
Range converter.
Okay.
It's like the primary way that I study. It's a pre-solved database where you can look at even post-flop spots, where like now I'm getting into tournaments. I'm like, okay, I'm not used to it folding to the small blind and having 25 big blinds. Like, what do I do here?
Right.
Go under range converter. Okay. You have this hand. You should raise.
Wow.
Okay. I raise to this 3X. He calls. The flop comes.
Is it easy to use?
Yeah. The flop comes this board texture. Should I bet?
Yeah.
No. Okay. I should check. If I do bet, what should my sizing be? We didn't have these tools available to us a long time ago. So it's such a great tool to help me study tournament spots. And they even have like a GTO trainer.
Do you have some future content plans that are bigger and better or different than what you're doing?
Yes, totally. I feel like every time around New Year's, you get this like buzz and energy.
Yeah.
Like
I get it.
Cause you evaluate,
me too.
You evaluate the previous year
and
you see where you fell short.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, you know what? I'm going to put some focus on.
Hence the New Year's resolutions.
Yeah. And New Year's resolutions are obviously bullshit.
They are.
But what isn't bullshit is the opportunity to evaluate how far you've come, where you fell short, and what maybe you can improve on next year.
And why you want a 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 exit.
Yeah, and I make no mistake about it. A lot of the opportunities that have come to my fruition in poker are because I've made content. And to turn my back on that, not only is turning my back on my community that I've built, it's turning the back on my back on something that is provided me such great opportunity. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to refocus and start making poker content again, which I think really in 2023, short form content is going to be like still like growing. So I'm going to make a big push back towards short form content.
Can you, people troll me because I didn't on Twitter know what double authentic, authorization, how do you say it? Authentication. Yeah. I don't know. I can't say it. Maybe I'm having a stroke.
Two factor authentication.
Yeah. And so I get trolled cause I don't know shit, which is fine. But like, what does short form content look like?
So
how short is it?
My current, content is very labor intensive. It is 12 minutes a video, which ends up being like 25 hours to produce.
Wow.
Short form content is something that will be on Instagram and be 45 seconds. It'll be a clip of me.
It'll be on YouTube as well?
Yeah, or YouTube Shorts or TikTok or things like that.
Because I want to do more of that, the shorts and stuff. You know what I need, but I don't have a budget for it? I mean, obviously I can afford it, but I don't have a budget for it. I need a, like, because I have Vincent, but Vincent runs like a lot of different businesses and things, and he's whatever. I need that. I need like to be able to fast real time, because I'm not good with technology. Like, I may want to just go get a hand and talk about that for 45 seconds, something really cool, a big hand, whatever, and just put out a short, put it out. But I just don't have like someone on staff that I could just say, do this, you know, and get it out, because I don't do those things.
Yeah. Well, you just advertise for it right now.
Okay. Vincent, it could be you if you want it, but
you know who's I need really it, good I need for it these?
Fast.
It's like young and hungry poker players or aspiring business people.
Okay.
Like, you know, 20 years old, willing to grind.
Yeah.
You know, that's the guy.
All right. If you're watching this, and like Vincent, I'm not cutting you out because you do good. You're my editor, your things, but you're busy. You're running big shit. So, and I'm talking about the type of thing where it could be like this, exactly. Right? Like where I could just keep tasking someone. So if you're out there and
I mean, this is how
DM me.
This is how I found the guy that lives with me in Vegas.
Yeah.
I was having online meetup games.
What is he? I don't mean what you pay him specifically, but what does he get out of it? But you just pay him per project. Like how does that work?
I'll get to that.
Well, okay.
But,
this is what part of the answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I met him through my online meetup games. And like I said before, like a lot of my audience is lower stakes players. So I was crushing these games, and he was like the one guy. There was a couple of guys, but he was one of the guys that was like holding his own and was like there every week.
Right.
Buying a hoodie when I put a hoodie on.
Right.
Clicking like on my videos, subscribing to the channel, commenting on the channel. And I just noticed him. I'm like, this guy showing up to in-life meetups, real in-person meetups.
Yes, yes, yes.
And just like the energy there, I'm like, this kid's hungry.
There's a lot of synergy because he was really vested in this life.
He battles hard at the poker table. Like, I've crushed him and he gets back up and he comes back the next week to like try to battle with me. I want to take a shot on this kid. Poor Mexican kid living in Montana. Like, it reminds me a lot of my brother. Reminds me a lot of my upbringing. Let's bring this kid in the fold and let's provide him every opportunity that I didn't have. And while it's, what's he getting out of it? He now gets to play in the biggest games that he could ever want.
Oh, okay. Because he's not just straight assistant. I get it.
He has access to Andrew. He has access to my
huge to
myself for
up.
A bankroll. He can ask Andrew any question. He gets to live in my apartment.
No, I got it. You like know, that like, guy's he stuck the landing.
Yeah. So
yeah, I don't want Vincent living with me. So,
but yeah, now he's part of the family. He's like a little brother, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually one of the reasons why all of my horse staking arrangements have worked, and it's because they've been a part of the family. When you're treating someone like an employee and an employee only, you tend to not be as hands-on with them.
Yeah.
They tend to not care about you as much, not work as hard. But when you bring them into the fold like a family member, like the guy that I was taking at Oceans, who I put in the bigger games.
Yes, yes.
The guy who now lives with me in Vegas. They want to work hard for me. They want to work hard for themselves. They want to make me proud as an older brother. All right, that was about 60% of the interview. If you want to catch more of it, you can always head over to Nick Bertucci's channel. Thanks for joining me on Embrace the Grind today. We'll be back with a new format and a new year better than ever.